All right. So, let's do this. Throughout history, music has been the core of the struggle for justice and equality in this country. During the slavery era, spirituals such as Wade in the Water were sung to alert escaped slaves that their masters knew that they were on the run and that they should wade in the water to throw off the scent of the dogs tracking them. In the civil rights era, in the 1950s and the 1960s, songs such as We Shall Overcome and Ain't Gonna Let Nobody Turn Me Around resonated in black churches and protest marches. So here we are in 2015, and the struggles for justice and equality continues. Is hip-hop the music of today? Is it the music of today's struggle? Will your songs and those of other hip-hop artists be remembered as the music that helped bring us through? Is this what hip-hop should be doing?
Absolutely. All good art takes its cues from the people. You know, artists have big egos. They want to be loved by everybody. So artists follow the movement of the community. Artists follow activists. Artists voice the struggle. You have the rare example of artists who rise above and go beyond the call of duty and actually become activists. Matter of fact, the Bay Area is very famous for that. You have people like Michael Franti and Boots from the Crew. You know what I'm saying? Like people who put the activism before the entertainment. But traditionally, entertainers have voiced the struggle. So if we want to see our entertainers voice our struggle more, then we need to be more active in our struggles and create the context for these entertainers to voice the struggle. So Wade in the Water, the context was there. For the civil rights movement, the context was there for when Ray Charles went to Alabama and they said, nah, Ray, you can't play this venue because this venue don't respect us. The context was there in the 60s when James Brown made Black and I'm Proud before they had he had the conk in his hair and then he got the afro. You know what I'm saying? Like, and he did I'm Black and I'm Proud. But when the context was no longer there, he put the conk back in his hair. You know what I'm saying? That don't make him any less of a great artist. It just means that art will always respond to the struggle. And right now in hip-hop, you know, I come from an era when hip-hop, conscious hip-hop or hip-hop that had message, was more popular in the mainstream as far as the mainstream hip-hop. Hip-hop was far more underground, but as far as popular hip-hop, the popular rappers at the time who were on the top of the charts and on the hip-hop radio stations were the Big Daddy Kanes and Rakim and X-Clan and Public Enemy, you know. And now it's not as different as it may seem, because even though the flashiest music is the music you go to the club and turn up to, that's the music you hear on the radio, that's the music you hear in the nightclubs, that's not the music that the people are really supporting with their dollars or the music that the hip-hop community is necessarily making the most popular. The most popular hip-hop artist right now in the world is Kendrick Lamar. You know what I'm saying? And Kendrick Lamar has put out a very black album, his second one in a row. And he has no radio hits. They're not playing any of these songs on the radio. They're not playing them in the clubs. But if you ask somebody who's the most popular rapper out now and who are the hip-hop fans checking for, they'll say Kendrick Lamar.
Cool. Let's talk about hip-hop and women. So in State of Grace on your Gravitas album, you say she did a paper on the state of the hip-hop generation, but she no longer felt a part of the conversation. And let's just listen to a little bit, if we can, from State of Grace.
She wanna be the first in the family with a higher education. Her entire graduation was a dire situation. Did a paper on the state of the hip-hop generation, but no longer felt a part of the conversation. Used to be I'm a ride or die chick, B.I.G. with the me and my no objections. Being an object, major label, seeing a profit. She ain't that, but she used to sing along when she heard it in a song. She used to be front row at the shows, and she overdosed on the testosterone. My favorite rapper invited her backstage for the stage, but she felt like she really ain't belong. Or she wouldn't let him hit the core, she erased all the songs from the phone.
Critics of hip-hop say that this music promotes violence against women and that hip-hop is testosterone-driven with little to no place for the female voice. Now, it is the fact women earn less than men for comparable work. Women worldwide are oppressed, second and even third-class citizens. So is hip-hop yet another form of oppression of women, and can women get a fair shake in the world of hip-hop?
So the society that we all live in promotes violence against women. Hip-hop just happens to be the most vocal, most accurate depiction of this society. I think it's a slippery slope and dangerous to start blaming art that exposes oppression, or that sometimes even celebrates being a victim of oppression, as the cause for oppression. So I would hesitate to blame hip-hop or any art that reflects a problem for that actual problem.
Interesting. Okay.
But there was a second part, right? I forgot.
Well, can women get a fair shake
in
the hip-hop world?
That song, State of Grace, is one of the most interesting, passionate songs I ever had to write.
It is.
And that song came out of a real experience that was very jarring for me. I've made songs, you know, as an American male, you know, I've been misogynistic. I've abused my privilege through my life when dealing with women, certainly. But in my music, I've tried to in the past represent women, especially women of color, in a positive light, and try to represent them in my music, whether it be through having female MCs on my projects, which I usually do, or making songs about women in my life, or my mother, or my daughter. It's something that I've actively tried to do. And, you know, when sometimes you feel like you have a relationship with a part of the community that you really don't. Last year, Rick Ross had a lyric in a song, You Ain't Even Know, that people had an issue with. And I'm somebody who, you know, I know Rick Ross. I'm a fan of his music. The first time I met Rick Ross was in a club in Miami. He came up to me and quoted the whole Respiration verse from the Black Star album. You know what I'm saying? So it's a respectful peer relationship I have with most artists. So when I see them do things that I don't like, that I don't condone, that would disappoint me personally, I'm not trying to cast them out of society and say, that's not hip hop. I'm just like, okay, if I do have a criticism of it and compassionate in my criticism. And I criticize that lyric in a public forum, but in my criticism of that lyric, which I stood firm on, I also was critical of people who take people like Rick Ross and Lil Wayne, who I think it's convenient to love hip hop when it's beautiful, and when it's ugly, be like, that's not hip hop. Lil Wayne is hip hop. Rick Ross is hip hop. You know, they grew up with a hip hop experience. They make hip hop for a living. It may not be the hip hop you like or I like that we grew up with, but to now say that they are not hip hop because we don't like their lyrics, to me, that's counterproductive. And you know, I'm not a Christian at all, but I do believe in the founding principle of dealing with all of this out of love. We protest out of love. We don't protest and stand up against injustice because we hate white people, because we hate cops, because we hate our enemy. We do it because we love ourselves so much that we won't let nobody undervalue us. You know what I'm saying? So, in my critique of that, it was misconstrued by there was a particular feminist blogger who said that I was a rape apologist and that I was an enemy to women, and wrote this whole piece about me that didn't quote what I said at all, just was her interpretation of what she thought I was trying to say. I thought that was very unfair, and maybe it was my ego, or maybe it was unfair for me to feel a way about it, but the idea, like, it really stung me to my heart for the efforts I put forth in my career, for someone to say he's a rape apologist, and for that to gain any traction. But the reason why I wrote that record out of that experience is because it made me realize that hip-hop, some of the messages in hip-hop, some of the lyrics, the misogyny has been so cutthroat, it's so horrible, and especially in corporate commercial hip-hop, which is marketed to us way more than, like, you know, traditional underground hip-hop, those messages have been so cutting and jarring that people automatically hear hip-hop and they just associate it with that. And so me being a rapper, it doesn't matter what I've done in the past. If I don't side with you on everything you're saying about Rick Ross right now, then I'm your enemy. And that to me speaks to such a deep hate that I can't relate to. Not a deep hate, that's the wrong word. A deep pain that I can't relate to. And so State of Grace was me trying to understand that pain, trying to put myself in that position, but also calling the community to task to say, listen, we can't be out here complaining about Lil Wayne and Rick Ross lyrics, and then when Jean Grey and Rhapsody drop records, we don't support them and buy their records. Right. You know what I'm saying? So I think it's something that we all have to learn. I have to learn how to not take offense to when someone points that laser at laid that microscope on me, but also I like to take our community to task.
Got it. In America, black males are 21 times more likely to die at the hands of the police than are white males. So what's real here? I mean, and in What's Real, your piece, you say the cops are lining their coffers while we get shot, we're lying in coffins. So let's hear just a clip, if we can, from What's Real.
I'm starting a story. My influence so enormous. Got the you love to sing along with. Like every line is the chorus. I'm born in Brooklyn like Biggie. I'm born in Brooklyn like Jordan. I'm born in Brooklyn like Tyson. You don't live this, you just a tourist. We ride or die for them corners. Your private life is by owners. When they catch us, man, it's like practice for the new tactics that they try on us. Them cops lining them coffers while we get shot with line in coffers.
So what can hip-hop artists do to reduce the numbers of those coffins?
I would take that out of the context of hip-hop. I think it diminishes the situation to always focus on what hip-hop, and particularly when we talk about hip-hop, we're really talking about rappers and MCs. Because when people say, what can hip-hop do? They're not talking about program directors or DJs or anybody who's buying the music. They're talking about rappers. You know what I'm saying? And I think it's dismissive of the problem to say, well, what can the entertainers do? You know, these are men in the community before they're rappers. And I think the problem starts in our homes. It starts in our schools. I think these rappers are painting accurate pictures of this environment. So, I mean, I think that question is more for parents, for educators. You know, there are rappers who are educated, and the rappers who are educated, I think you see them speak on it. You know, recently you had, 2 Chainz on Nancy Grace sounded real intelligent. You know what I'm saying? So when you ask the rappers who are educated on those issues, they can sound intelligent, but he did mention, you know, I'm still an entertainer, you know? So it's like, I don't think there's much to be done as a rapper. The fact of the matter is that as entertainers, we have a platform that's bigger. And so you have to be responsible if you have a larger platform for the things you say. You have a larger reach, a larger audience. But that voice that you're amplifying doesn't belong to you. That voice you're amplifying belongs to this movement, belongs to these people. And if they don't raise their voice, there's nothing to amplify. It's not about, too often people, it's too convenient to say, well, what are the rappers doing? You know, I'm on Twitter every day, and I get challenged every day by people who I can tell from the way they question me, don't know about my efforts or what I do. And one thing that I always push back with is, well, you know, you're saying, why don't these rappers say all the time, but what exactly are you doing? What organizations do you belong to? What marches have you gone to? What actions have you taken? What are you doing besides reposting memes and pictures of Sam Jackson with quotes? What else are you actually doing? You know what I'm saying? And when I push back with that, I usually get people really angry and upset because they have no response. Mm-hmm. The people who are actually doing the work, they have no time to do that. You know what I'm saying? They have no time to do that. They have no time to be wondering what Lupe Fiasco's doing. You know?
Good. So, this man is on it here. All right. So, all of us, everyone in this theater, you,
yes,
me, all of us have biases. Now, they're explicit or conscious biases, and then there's implicit or the unconscious biases. Now, a recent study, it was done actually in 2013, concluded that African American children are, and I'm quoting from the study, assumed to be older, less innocent, and inherently guilty. That's from that study. Now, the people who made those assumptions would undoubtedly deny that they were racist, yet it is clear that their biases, their unconscious, implicit bias, and beliefs about black children are racist. 12-year-old Tamir Rice, killed in Cleveland, was described by the police officer who called in the shooting as being a 20-year-old. So, Talib, what is to be done? How do we, and that's all of us, combat that implicit bias within us, and especially that implicit bias when it comes to policing?
I think we have to combat it. The best way to combat it is to first recognize what it is. American history, we've never been honest with the root causes of racism. Racism is, you know, there's been tribalism and classism all through history, but racism, the idea that this, the racism that's based on white supremacy, which is the racism that runs America and then thus has run the world, was invented to justify the profits from the slave trade. They didn't, you know, they wanted to feel good about themselves for trading in black flesh. So, you know, they invented this system that whites are superior, and anyone, you know, the darker you are, the less closer to that superiority you are. And
the less human.
Less human, that's right. And, you know, they put the laws on the books. The white supremacists are the founding fathers of this country. This country was founded by white supremacy. And the genius of it is that they've created a system that constantly perpetuates itself. So slavery turns into Jim Crow. That turns into segregation, and that turns into the Republicans wanting to take the South back. And so convincing the Democrats in the South that the inner cities are filled with these monsters and these superhuman predators. You know, so then they start voting Republican, they start voting for Nixon, and then they create this law and order society. Now you have the prison industrial complex, where prisoners have the same exact rights the slaves had. So slavery is not outlawed, it's just now you have to be in a prison to be a slave.
Different form.
So it's the same system of profiting off of black flesh, black death. It's just more sophisticated now. So now it doesn't, you say the prison industrial complex, like that is the new slavery. So in order for it to work, you have to usher poor people in there. You have to usher people of color in there. In order to usher them, you have to criminalize them. You have to make them seem like criminals at all times, so that when you shoot them in the head for no reason, no one doubts you. You're like, well, he was a thug anyway. You know, he must have did something wrong. He must have stole some cigars, something. He must have did something. You know, you talked about Tamir Rice with Michael Brown. You know, Darren Wilson described him as, he said he had demons in his eye. He had a demonic look in his eye. And he said, I felt like I was wrestling with Hulk Hogan. You know, so what he was saying was that this 18-year-old, you know, was the spawn of Satan with 24-inch pythons coming at him. And you know what I'm saying? Like, and he got away with that. It's not so much that he said it is the problem. It's that he said it and the grand jury or whoever was listening was like, well, yeah, that makes sense. You know? And so that's the real enemy. Of course, there's always going to be a racist person, a crazy person, a psychopath. But when the system allows for these people, and that's why the report, the Department of Justice report, was so important. The hypocrisy
the one
of it.
On Ferguson?
Yeah, yeah, the one on Ferguson. The hypocrisy of saying that clearly here's a system that allowed for this man's death to happen, but this cop has no responsibility for it, even though the system is completely set up to protect his way of thinking.
Yeah, and just as an observation, pick up on that, here in San Francisco, 58% of the jail population is African American, and yet only 5% of the population in San Francisco is African American. Mm. So more than 10 times the representation in the jail.
And then if you add in, you know, unemployment rates about, you know, why people might turn to crime, you know, that you have to add that in too. I think there's so many factors that, because people, you know, I see this stat throwing back and forth online all the time, and people, you know, somebody take facts, stats from a conservative website and compare them with someone who has stats from a liberal website, and, you know, but they're just ignoring the entire problem. I get a lot of, pushback when I say white supremacy, when I say white privilege. And, you know, so much pushback that it makes me sometimes question whether or not that's the right language, but I struggle to find any other way to describe it for what it is. And if you And I think that's where solidarity comes into play. You know, I think it's important for people who understand that, to understand that those numbers, to understand why we say Black Lives Matter, that of course all lives matter, but that's been proven to be obvious. It's not so obvious to Black Lives Matter. And until Black Lives Matter, all lives won't matter. So it don't make sense to say.
Okay, so let's change things up here a little bit, and let's do what I call a lightning round. So I'd like to give you just 20 seconds,
okay,
and you tell us what you think of these public figures, okay? All right. You can do this. You can do this.
It depends on the names. So 20 seconds might be too much or too little.
Well, we're going to do this. 20 seconds. All right, here we go. All right. Barack Obama.
Barack Obama is the most death-defying of the odds person has ever existed. He is the greatest politician to ever walk the earth. Whether you agree with his politics or not, the obstruction he's faced, he has jumped over every hurdle in a way that I thought was not possible. So, you know, big up to him for that.
All right. All right. Okay. Al Sharpton.
With all due respect, Al Sharpton had... Now you're funny. I got 20 seconds, man. Relax. Al Sharpton has a very sort of civil rights Negro way of dealing with new problems. And I think that Al Sharpton would do better if he didn't always look for the soundbite. I think Al Sharpton says a lot of things that people in his audience relate to, but I think his tactics and his strategy are completely off and completely out of date, and it makes him look crazy to people.
All right. Hillary Clinton.
Hillary Clinton, that's going to be our first female president.
Oh, really? Yeah. You think so?
You know, to be honest, I don't pay that much attention to politics, but when I do, it's pretty simple to figure out. It's pretty easy to figure out. I can't think of a time when I've guessed who was going to be the president. I've been wrong. I've never been wrong. It was clear to me George Bush was going to win. It was clear to me Barack Obama was going to win. People were like, of course he's going to win. There's no competition for him. The only competition for Hillary Clinton is Rand Paul. If Rand Paul decides to run, Is he running?
Oh, he hasn't decided yet.
I don't know. If Rand Paul decides to run, he might be a problem. Nobody else got nothing for her.
Wow. All right. Okay. Bill Cosby.
Oh. I grew up emulating Bill Cosby. When I was in junior high school, I memorized the routine from himself, the Moses. Moses?
Oh, yeah.
You know, Moses, Noah.
Noah.
Noah, yes, God, about Noah and the cubits. I memorized that. You know, Bill Cosby has a lot of accusations and allegations against him. Shout out to Hannibal Buress. I hope y'all get to check out Dave Chappelle tonight. He's somewhere in the city. There we go. That's how I'll answer that question.
All right. All right. Okay, just two more. All right. Lauryn Hill.
Lauryn Hill is the epitome of Black power, Black beauty, Black excellence. And regardless of whether or not she shows up on time to your show, you should be in protection mode of our sister at all times. Because what Lauryn Hill has already given us, Lauryn Hill don't ever have to show up at another show again. She don't ever have to do another song. What she's already given us, what Lauryn already gave us for a miseducation, all of us owe her another $20.
That's right.
All of us.
All right. All right, one more. Macklemore.
Macklemore, that's the homie. Macklemore, I've learned so much from Macklemore and Ryan Lewis. They have completely revolutionized the way I saw my career, the way that I've sold my music, the way that I connect with my audience. They brought me on the road with them, me and Big Crit. Macklemore, 5 years ago when he was going under the name Professor Macklemore, he made a record called White Privilege. That record he did before this was a buzzword on Twitter, before he blew up as Macklemore and, you know, before any of that. You know, before anyone in this room, hardly anybody knew who Macklemore is, he was honestly dealing with his privilege in a very artistic way. And I think the one pushback people have against artists like him is that they refuse to deal with their privilege. Macklemore is the rare exception to that rule. There's others, but he's one of them. He's in the streets protesting with the people. A great human being, and I'm honored to know him.
Right. All right. Thank you. So that was my list, but I have one more 20-second thing. I'm just going to give you a sentence to finish. 20 seconds.
Okay.
Here's the sentence.
I wish more rappers would respect the rudiments in the history of hip-hop and have more of an understanding of the people who came before them, whose backs and shoulders that they're standing on. Yeah, that's it.
Wonderful. So now let's talk about hip-hop and leadership. You have one of your songs on Gravitas is New Leaders, and you talk about leadership, and I want to know, who are our new leaders? I mean, do we have any? I mean, should we have any? And if so, who are they? And you have a huge following, which I think makes you a leader, whether you want to be or not. So are you the leader?
Wow. Yeah, I mean, I think once you say something, once you do something, whether you say something on a record or you show up at a protest, once you take on that responsibility, the leadership comes with it. I think that's why so many artists are scared to say something, because they're not ready to be leaders, and they know that. They know that once they say one little thing, it's going to be dissected and picked apart, and they're going to have to be responsible for what they say and do. Because of my career, because of the things that I've chosen to address in my music, first of all, I was raised a certain way. I was raised in a sort of academic black nationalist household that was very focused on community and very focused on knowing where you come from. And that was instilled in me. So when I was in junior high school, the type of hip-hop that was popular was that type of hip-hop, the artists I had mentioned before, like KRS-One and Chuck D and all them. So when I started my hip-hop career, that was always important to me. So early in my career, I worked with organizations like Refuse and Resist and Malcolm X Grassroots Movement. And I got to see the world and travel to South Africa and travel to Cuba and build with other movements and organizations and freedom fighters, and I got to do all that early in my career, and it set the stage for this trajectory that I was on, to whereas now I have a privilege that I have a following. I have people who are listening to me. So what am I going to do with it? I start looking towards those who come before me. I did an album called Prisoner Conscious. The point of Prisoner Conscious for me as an artist was to do an album that was just as dope, that was less focused on my lyrics. I felt like people were paying so much attention to my lyrical ability, they weren't noticing the music. So all the interviews were about the lyrics, the lyrics, the lyrics. It's like, yeah, but I'm working with Madlib and Just Blaze and Kanye West, and y'all not mentioning none of that. Y'all just talking about the lyrics. So the focus of Prisoner Conscious was, how can I do an album that allows people to see me as bigger than just a great lyricist? But naming it Prisoner Conscious, naming it POC, where I spelled it not like conscious in the mind, but naming it that, I'm like, I can't put an album out there without connecting with actual POCs. I've always been connected with Malcolm X Grassroots Movement that's always given money to prisoners of conscience. But I went to see Mumia, and then I went to see Harry Belafonte, and Harry Belafonte told me, you know what, go see the Dream Defenders. I had never heard of the Dream Defenders. He said, go see Phil Agnew and the Dream Defenders. I went down to Tallahassee. I went there the day after Jesse Jackson was there. You know what I'm saying? Like, so it was like, I was like, okay, now I'm moving in these circles of the people that I read about growing up. So what does that mean for me?
Right.
You know, who am I? Like I am I that person that I've been talking about? Am I? So all that came to a head when I was talking about all this on Twitter in the midst of the Ferguson thing. What I was seeing online surrounding the death of Michael Brown was very different than what I was seeing in the mainstream media. And I was talking about it online, and I'm like, yeah, but I could just get up and go. I don't have a 9-to-5. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm my own boss. I can just get up and go. And most people who are talking about it don't have that privilege. They don't have that luxury. So as I grow older, look, I'm not interested in changing careers or being looked at as a community activist. I'm on tour with Immortal Technique right now. We at the Fillmore. If you didn't get your ticket, too late, sold out. on Sunday. We at the Catalyst in Santa Cruz if you want to make the drive tomorrow. That's not sold out yet, but it's like 85% sold out. So, but Immortal Technique is like the artist like Boots or Michael Franti that I'm talking about. Like, he's like, I'm a community activist. He teaches in the prisons. This and that. Like, I don't consider myself that. I consider myself an entertainer.
But you're a leader.
Well, I have to be because I've put these things into my music. If I didn't put these things into my music, I could just be like, you know, whatever, out here turning up and not speak on nothing.
But you would agree that's a huge responsibility. You're a leader.
It is, but it's a position I've been thrust into by the trajectory of my life.
Oh, I'm glad. Very glad.
Thank you.
This year, we commemorate the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and the movie Selma depicted the struggle, the lives lost, and the sacrifices of so many so that African Americans and then others could gain access to the ballot box. Now, word is that you do not vote or that you rarely vote. Please explain yourself.
Yes, I have no problem. Voting in this country, the way it's set up, from the beginning, remember we talked about white supremacy and this country being set up by white supremacists. One of the things they set up was the Electoral College to make sure that the popular vote isn't always what's right. They set it up so that rich, male, white landowners would always have more power in this country. That's what the Electoral College is about. So knowing that, knowing that voting just becomes a popularity contest, from my perspective as a young man growing up in Brooklyn, New York, I didn't see how whether or not we had a Democrat or Republican in office. The two-party system is something I have an issue with as well. I didn't see that as changing any conditions in the hood from the perspective I was on. I was that. So as a young man, yeah, I've said in many interviews and song lyrics, and I did a magazine where I debated Al Sharpton actually about this. Well, I'm like, yo, I don't see voting as something that I personally need to be doing. I don't see me voting in New York for a Democrat because the Democratic candidate for president, and I'm just talking about presidential politics at this stage. The Democratic candidate for president in New York, from where I was standing as a little, it was going to win anyway, based on the Electoral College. So I didn't see the point in me doing that. I felt justified in saying that because of my efforts in the community. It's not like I'm saying I don't vote and I don't just do nothing. I'm saying I don't vote because I'd rather put my efforts here. I feel like me working with political prisoners, me working with Malcolm X grassroots movement, me doing the music I do is more important than my vote. As I've grown older, now I voted for Bill Clinton in the second time. It was the first time that I was able to vote. Because I hadn't developed the stage, I saw him playing saxophone on Arsenio. You know what I'm saying? I was like, seems black enough to me. I voted for Bill Clinton as a young man. I became more disillusioned with the process over the Clinton administration. I didn't vote for Al Gore. I didn't vote for John Kerry. Barack Obama showed up. I wrote a long piece on MySpace about why I was going to support Barack Obama. After being harassed by my grandmother and my mother and my brother, who actually flew out to Iowa at some point to assist with the campaign, I had to really think about why I wouldn't vote for Barack Obama. And I decided to support him, but I supported him symbolically. He was going to win New York, and like I said before, it was no question in my mind that Barack Obama was going to win. No question. The same way when I saw OJ on trial, I'm like, oh, he's getting off. You know, so certain things that seem to baffle other people in this country, I would look at it and be like, ah, yeah, he's getting off. He got Johnny Cochran, he's getting off. So I voted for him symbolically because of everything I said about him when you asked about the 20s. I'm like, I'm looking at this man's life and what he's had to overcome and what he's done. And it's like, you know what? Maybe I don't agree with every single little thing he says, but I need to be voting for the first black president. You know, hands down, I need to. That's something that goes beyond politics for me. That's something that my kids, like I grew up, there are people in this audience who are older than me. But I remember being a little kid, and if someone told me there was a black president, I would have said, impossible. No way, that's not happening, ever. So just symbolically, I felt like my vote was symbolic. But again, I felt like it was symbolic at that point. Now, more recently, I read Manning Marable's book on Malcolm X when it came out, the week after Marable passed away, rest in peace. And his chapter or section on Adam Clayton Powell, relationship with Malcolm X. Mm-hmm. Now that I have more experience as an adult, now that I know more about politics, I can see how someone being organized in a community like that, school board elections, assemblymen, assemblywomen, organizing block voting in a community so that you can have real political power, you can really affect change. I can see how that can be effective. So my thinking on that has evolved. Like, yes, if someone's doing that, I'm down with that. Or if we raise an activist from our community that I know for sure has been invested in the community for his entire life, not just a politician who once he gets elected going to spend his entire career trying to get reelected, but an actual community activist like my man Ralph Baraka, who's now mayor of Newark. You know what I'm saying? Like someone who I went to Cuba with. You know what I'm saying? If I see that, I can support that. If I see somebody doing block voting, I can support that. But blindly telling people just vote because someone died for it, I can't support that.
So, but you would support then people getting out and voting and involved in local elections?
I think that has far more effect.
I mean,
on
I
the
say
community.
That because yeah. I was elected to
definitely.
The bench.
I'm aware. I'm aware. Right. But you know, I had to learn about that because, as you know, growing up. People don't talk about that. People don't talk about local elections. Right. We talk about voting and elections strictly on the presidential level. And when I had kids and my kids started having to go to school, that's when I started being more involved in local elections and started supporting local politicians who became visible, who made my radar. Because there's a lot of local politicians who just had the same job for 40 years and they're contributing to the problem.
So Talib, you attended private school. Your parents are professionals. Your brother is a law professor. Yet, you know, I remember your lyrics in one of your songs. We played it here. I'm born in Brooklyn like Jordan. I'm born in Brooklyn like Tyson. You don't live this. You just a tourist. We ride or die for them corners. So my question to you is that really you? Is that your experience? And the bigger question is, can a rapper, can a hip-hop artist be credible if your experience really isn't, at least growing up, right from the streets?
Yeah, certainly. You know, like you said, my parents are teachers. Anyone who's a teacher or work with teachers know that's no money involved in that. You know what I'm saying? So you're definitely not, like, while I'm blessed and while I'm super privileged to grow up in an academic household, that's something that I must acknowledge. It had nothing to do with a financial situation. Like, we didn't grow up rich. And I didn't grow up poor. I didn't want for anything. My parents worked very hard. But they were, you know, they were academics. And so when I started falling victim to the allure of the city, instead of letting me just become another statistic, they took me out of the system and they scraped by and they got second jobs. And they went through a lot of problems in between themselves just from the stress of having to deal with a wayward kid and sent me away to boarding school and saved my life. And, you know, God bless them for that. I think that, and that's given me a leg up. It has. My parents provided an extra layer of privilege that most people from where I'm from did not get to have. Now, when I talk about being from Brooklyn and, you know, if, you know, the Bay Area is a place that is almost or just as proud as New York City, particularly, you know, the connection between Oakland and Brooklyn. You know what I'm saying? Like, like the same way people respond about Brooklyn around the world is the way people respond about Oakland. Matter of fact, they respond about you don't even have to say Oakland. You could just say the town. They know what you're talking about. They know what you're talking about. You know, what town? You know what town? You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, you feel this hometown pride, and we deal with gentrification and these cycles of gentrification. In Brooklyn, if you've watched HBO show Girls, you can see it's very real. You know what I'm saying? Like, and, you know, I'm a big movie head. And so when I say we, to borrow from the movie Big Lebowski, I mean the royal we. You know what I'm saying? So when I say we ride or die, I'm not saying I ride or die. I do. But I'm talking about my community in general. We, as the collective of the community, this is how we respond to things. And to borrow from another movie, the movie Fight Club. Scene in Fight Club, you know, where, you know, Ed Norris' character is mad at Marla because she's coming to the testicular cancer meetings. And he's like, you don't have testicular cancer. You're just a Taurus. And that's that line always stay with me. I'm like, right. That's how I feel about people who deal with things they don't really know about. Like, you're just a Taurus. I travel the world. I try not to be a Taurus when I travel. I try hard not to be a Taurus. Sometimes I am. Sometimes I'm like Rick Ross and the Jay-Z song, like, I landed in Europe, I'm a Taurus. You know, sometimes I feel like that, you know, but I try not to be a Taurus. But in Brooklyn, and I'm sure in Oakland, and I'm sure in San Francisco, if you're from here, you look around, you see somebody in your neighborhood, you're like, you're a Taurus. You're just here. Yeah.
So we're going to go to our first question. Go ahead, sweetie.
How you doing?
Hi.
Go ahead.
My name is Ion.
Hi, Ion.
How old are you?
Seven now.
Are you sure?
Is that a question? All right, go ahead, sweetie. What's your question?
My question is, did you ever write poetry?
Ah. That's a wonderful question.
Thank you for that question. Let's give a hand for that. Oh, my goodness.
Yes, I appreciate the question. Yes, hip-hop is poetry. There's no difference. Hip-hop music is poetry set to a beat. So, yes, I write poetry, and I continue to write poetry, and I hope you write some poetry.
All right. We have another question.
Hey, how you doing?
Peace.
What makes you think you can succeed where other people have failed?
Well, that's more of a past tense thing. You know. So what made me think? I think that early in my career I changed my definition of success. I think the definition of success in the simplest terms is doing what you love for a living. So you don't have to be rich or poor. It don't matter if you're rich or poor. You will be happy if you're doing what you love for a living. Being happy is being successful. So I just decided as long as I found a way to make music or create for a living, I would always be happy, and being happy would ensure my success. And that's been my plan, and it's worked out.
Thank you. All right.
Thank you.
What role do entertainers play in the industry in terms of feeding or fighting the prison industrial complex and the role that it plays in perpetuating negative stereotypes of black people?
Okay. Well, first of all, thank you for your poetry, brother. There are several entertainers, I would like to say myself, you know, Chuck D., Jasiri X, you know, there's a lot of people who push actively and clearly against the prison industrial complex and all its tentacles. They're not necessarily on the mainstream. The most mainstream artist to ever do it is Kanye West. Kanye West on Yeezus album, he pushed back against the prison industrial complex and the idea of what it meant to be black and undervaluing black lives several times. On the album, we're very much concerned about his tight jeans or whoever he's having sex with, that sometimes people miss some of the messages. You know what I'm saying? We get caught up in a bunch of other things. But I think Kanye is the most mainstream artist to do it. I will say I'm very much against, like we talked about earlier, blaming art for our oppression. But I will say that there are a lot of hip-hop artists that are unwilling and unwittingly participating in helping the prison industrial complex. I don't think they know any better. I think they're just as much victims of the system as the people that they're rapping to. And so I don't look at them as like, oh, it's your fault. But yes, there are rappers who perpetuate stereotypes perpetuate imagery and make money off of it, that the stereotypes and imagery that don't steer our people away from the prisons, but steer our people to the prisons. I think the way to combat that is to not castigate them and not belittle them and cast them out the community and say, you have nothing of value to offer, but show them the other way. Show them by my example, like you just did, by your poetry, by me rapping, you know, show them like, look, I could do what you do and I'm doper. You know what I'm saying? Like, because my music is not empty. That's the only way to do it, not to shake a finger and be like, that rock and roll is bad for the kids. Like, but you know what I'm saying? Like, to really show, lead by example, I think is the only way that people could do it. And as far as fans and consumers, to not spend all your time talking about how much you don't like this rapper, what he's doing, pay no attention to it. Pay no attention, because even when you talk about it, you're caught up in the same flashing lights that you criticize. You know what I'm saying? When you don't like a certain artist and you're retweeting memes with this artist, you're helping that artist to promote himself. You know what I'm saying? So promote something you like. You know, come to events like this. Like, I think that's the only way to combat it. I think that's the only relevant way to combat that.
Okay, but before we go to the next question, I'm just going to throw a quick one in and just a very quick mm-hmm. response. What's your opinion of Empire?
I don't watch soap operas.
You don't watch soap operas?
Empire, look, I am friends with the entire cast of Empire. That's all my peoples. And they seem to be doing very well. And I'm happy that everybody likes the show. But I'm not in that demographic. It's not for me. You know, I'm sure it's very good.
All right. Next question.
Hello. I'm a huge fan of yours and Idol Worship. I've seen you at Yoshi's in the town many times. So my question was super similar to K-Swift's. But I don't know if you're familiar with drill music.
In Chicago,
yeah. So I was wondering, you mentioned something about like the people having to activate the artists. They have to have some type of context for some of the political and social activist movements that they make. But in what world, what way do you think capitalism, what role do you think capitalism plays in perpetuating pretty much the same reason why Rick Ross is so popular? The issues and isms and the sort of just widespread black death that's occurring, he makes money off of it. And not only does he make money off of it, the record labels themselves and the corporations that propagate this music, they make money off of it too. And it also provides a way for young black men.
Okay, we need the question.
Yeah,
all right.
To be,
okay,
right.
All right, go ahead.
Brief.
All right.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we worship capitalism. And clearly, capitalism creates rewards for sin and creates rewards for division. And certainly, I see flaws in other systems as well. You know, capitalism is extremely flawed. I think socialism is extremely flawed. So I don't throw my weight behind or spend too much time debating which system is better. I just try to find the things that work for me. I guess if you're asking if part of what this death and destruction has happened in our community has been being driven by capitalism, certainly. I don't think anybody could debate that. Yeah. And being driven by capitalism that creates consumerism, that creates us wanting things that we don't actually need, you know, the way advertising works. You know, look, I don't have any problem with doing what you want and fulfilling your desires and your wants and your needs. I'm a Libra. I believe in balance. You know what I'm saying? Like, I think you just need to be balanced. But I do think that we live in a society that encourages you to fulfill your desires and put your desires above anything else. And I think we do need to actively push back against that at all times.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you for the question. Next question.
Peace, Kwali.
Peace.
I'd like to give you a shout first for your work in promoting the Free Mumia movement.
Oh, yeah.
Some people aren't aware of that situation, so artists like you promoting that cause, I really appreciate that.
Yeah, and all political prisoners.
Yeah, for sure. Free them all. I'd also like to give you a shout for the Liberation Joint.
Liberation 2 coming very soon.
With Madlib?
Yeah.
That's what's up. So you said you grew up in a home that had like an essence of black nationalism. Mm-hmm. I was wondering how your parents, how they instilled that in the home, in their children, and also what your relationship now is with Pan-African scholars like Dr. Francis Cress Wilson mm-hmm. and our ancestor John Henry Clark
yes.
and other ancestors.
My parents would, you know, they did everything they could. My parents, I was very blessed to grow up around educators. We went to the museum every week, every weekend, went to the libraries every weekend. We celebrated Kwanzaa. We had African art all through the household. My parents named me Talib Kweli Green. They named my brother Jamal Kwame Green. The African in us was on full display whenever we left the crib. You can't be no, we can, but it'd be harder to be a crackhead with a powerful name. I'm glad you raised Pan-Africanism because, again, it started with, like, the cultural nationalism of the 60s, and my parents grew more into, like, Pan-Africanism. Because that stuff was in the house early, it made me want to invest in that. Hip-hop, it was a perfect storm of Pan-Africanism invading hip-hop when I was in junior high school, which I feel like is the age that you're most impressionable. That made me realize that when I quit college, I went to NYU and I quit, but I wanted to get a job before I quit. I was like, I'm either going to work in a bookstore or a record store because those are my interests. Ended up working at a bookstore called Inkiru Books in Brooklyn. It was a black-owned bookstore. It's the first black-owned bookstore in Brooklyn. And I worked there. And it was not only was the first black bookstore in Brooklyn, but it also had book signings. So anybody who black who wrote a book between 1985 and 1992, I met them, every single one. Whether it was Francis Cress Welsing or Malefe Asante or Akima Adebuti or Sonia Sanchez or whoever, like whoever wrote a book, Maya Angelou, Johnny Cochran, Angela Davis, Elaine Brown, all these people came through Inkiru. I wouldn't have been there if my parents didn't provide that foundation. I wouldn't have sought out that bookstore. And my career started at that bookstore. I used to do open mics called Foundations. And Jessica Care Moore and Saul Williams and Mums the Schemer and Lord Jamar and Deb Prez and Company Flow and Mos Def and all these people would come through. And that's really where my career started, was in that bookstore. But it definitely all started in the home with my parents. Definitely.
Hi, so how do you feel about like Iggy Azalea and Macklemore winning best hip-hop albums of the year, and what do you think that says about white supremacy in hip-hop?
I think it makes total sense. I do.
Why?
I mean, since when have the Grammys been about artistic achievement? They never... Yeah. I'm really surprised. I don't think that we should ignore it. And I don't think that we should just sit back and take it. But I am surprised when people are shocked and flabbergasted. Like, how could she? She was easily the most popular white rapper to white people. Easily. There's no competition. Like, for real. Like, every once in a while, somebody will win a Grammy. You know, every once in a while, the planets will be out of... Herbie Hancock won one about 5 years ago. Everybody was like, what? Nobody even. But you know, it's whatever Herbie Hancock did that year. His album was very popular with mainstream older white people who were on the Grammy committee, and that's who wins. It's a popularity contest. That's all it is. Macklemore is easily the most popular rapper in mainstream America. He gets the Grammy. You know, that's how it go.
All right, we have last question. Last question.
Hi, I'm a fan.
Hi.
So, Black Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. It's powerful, it's beautiful, and it's truth. My question to you is, sadly, there's oppression within oppression within oppression. So when do you think hip-hop will speak openly about trans black lives, queer black lives? And do you see yourself as a part of that conversation? Thank you so much.
Thank you. When do I think hip-hop will talk about trans black lives, when there is a rapper that defies the odds, and and makes a piece of art that everyone can't front on. Now, I've said things like this before, and I've gotten pushback from people who will be like, well, there are. You just don't know about them. And people will send me links and this and that. And that, to me, doesn't count. Because not that I'm trying to discount anyone's creative expression, but it makes me think of, I'm not saying it's not happening, but when it's happening to the point where it's so big it's undeniable, that's when it'll change. Is that fair? No, I don't think that's fair at all. I just think that's how it is. I think, you know, with Eminem, before Eminem, if you had told me that there would ever be a white dude considered as the best rapper ever, I would have said, no, impossible. People had to see it first. You know, and I do know that there's a community of, there's a gay and lesbian community, a trans community of hip hop that I'm not tapped into. I know it's big. I know it's out there. I see it on YouTube every once in a while. I don't know the names. But I know a Big Frida. That's the most famous name. I know about Big Frida, you know. But me saying Big Frida is like someone saying, hey, man, I heard of Jay-Z. You know what I'm saying? Like, so what, am I a part of that conversation? Sadly, no, I'm not. Not, I could do way better at being a part of that conversation. And when you step up and ask me that question and challenge me, it forces me to have to do better because I have to be responsible for my answer.
All right. Thank you. So, sadly, we have come to the final minute of an extraordinary conversation, and it is the tradition within Forum to take the last minute and ask of our guest, and here, Talib, here is the question. What is your 60-second idea to change the world?
See, now...
You can do this.
You told me you were going to ask me that earlier. And I immediately was like, oh, yeah, no problem. I can answer that. But I really did not come up with an answer. And I was thinking, I was really thinking hard, but, you know, I don't have the answer because I, maybe by default, look to young people. I look to actual activists on the ground to provide me direction. You ask who the new leaders are, those are the new leaders. They're not famous. They're not rappers. Rappers won't save you. They're kids on the ground. Regular people, regular working folks who have gotten tired of stuff. It's not the traditional activist community, the traditional sort of colored folk community, not the traditional, none of that. It's a new thing that's happening. What I will say is, because I come from educators, I think education is important. I think us being more involved in our schools and introducing the concepts of privilege and the newer, more progressive concept of racism into our school system would go a long way.
Wow. So, let us all give a huge, big shout out for Talib for sharing his time, his talent, his thoughts, his music with all of us. Thank you all. Good evening. Thank you all for being here tonight.
Thank you.